Hello, everybody, and welcome to the SoxProspects.com podcast. This is episode 109. Thank you for the download. My name is Chris Hatfield. I'm the executive editor of Sox Prospects, coming to you from the Mid-Atlantic offices here in our nation's capital. We've got a great show for you today. Alex Speer of the Boston Globe and Baseball America will be joining us to discuss his top 10 rankings of the Sox Prospect system, which were published recently. First, let me introduce my co-hosts. Joining me, as always, the managing editor of Sox Prospects, Matthew Heagle. Matt, how are you?
Hey, Chris and Ian. Excited to talk to Alex. Always appreciate him coming on.
And as Matt referenced, we are also joined by the director of scouting of Sox Prospects, Ian Kundle. Hello, Ian.
Matt, with no spoiler alert there, who the other guest was, shaking my head. No, I'm looking forward to talking to Alex because it's always fun when we've done this for the last couple of years and, you know, always get good insight and some good tidbits about this Red Sox system.
Yeah, this is the fourth year that we've had Alex on the show. It's always a pleasure to talk to him. Make sure that you follow him on Twitter, follow the 108 Stitches newsletter and the 108 Stitches podcast. We'll get more into that with Alex. But a few things before we get rolling. First off, if you downloaded it, we would really appreciate if you subscribe, rate, and review. Great way to help the podcast. Do us a favor and do that. We would really, really appreciate it. Want to give thanks to the Ludlow Thieves for our intro music. And I guess before we talk to Alex, just so we can kind of save time, we'll not go through this while we've got him on the phone. His top 10 rankings published recently in Baseball America are as follows. At the top of the list, he ranked outfielder Andrew Benintendi number one ahead of Yoan Moncada, who, of course, everyone will remember as playing third base at the end of the year. We'll definitely want to talk to him about that because, of course, we have Moncada ahead of Benintendi. At number three, like us, he's got Rafael Devers. He's got Michael Kopech, the right-handed flamethrower, at number four ahead of Jason Groom, the left-hander who the Red Sox drafted in the first round this year. We're definitely going to want to talk to him about that as well. So that's going to be another great topic of discussion on the podcast. He rounds out his top 10 with first baseman Sam Travis at number six. Infielder, or I guess a utility player, Mauricio Dubon at number seven. I always say Dubon, it's Dubon. At number seven, he's got the center fielder Luis Alexander Basabe at number eight. Third baseman Bobby Dalbec, the Red Sox fourth round pick in the 2016 draft at number nine. I think that's where you had him, Ian, correct, in your personal list?
Yes, I can bring it up. I had him.
No, I'm fairly certain you did.
It was either eight or nine. I think it was nine.
Yep. I think he had him at nine. And then at number 10, actually, something that I'm definitely going to want to ask him about, he had the young right-hander, Ronnie Araudes, who spent this year at age 18 with the Greenville Drive. He rounds out his top 10 with Araudes. So that's going to be another thing I definitely want to ask Alex about. So we'll get that and, of course, try and get some tidbits from who he has outside of his top 10, maybe some guys who just missed, some guys he has lower down. You know, maybe does he agree with us, not agree with us? We'll get into all of that and more in our interview with Alex. And we are now joined for the fourth time. He has been a guest on the podcast, which I think means we owe him a set of steak knives or something by the inimitable Alex Speer. Alex, thank you once again for coming on for what is now our annual rankings chat and kind of state of the system chat. It's a pleasure, as always, to have you on, good sir.
Thanks well, the pleasure us. Is fine, although I still haven't received the butter knives that I was previously promised, so I'll believe the steak knives when I'm cutting into red meat.
Fair enough. Well, let's make sure, just to make sure we don't forget, let's get the plugs in up front. Everyone should follow you on Twitter, at Alex Speer, correct? There's no...
Sure, by all means. Yeah, there are no secret, punctuation characters all to right. that.
And then, of course, everyone should subscribe. In addition to reading Alex's work in the Boston Globe, as well as in the Baseball America Prospect Handbook and on the website right now, there's 108 Stitches, the newsletter. How can people subscribe to that, Alex? Do they just go to the Globe's website?
You can find it in the Globe's Red Sox website, or you can also find the link directly through my Twitter page.
Excellent. And then I also have to say, I was listening back to our interview with you last year, and I was bemoaning the lack of Alex Speer in the podcast world, but 108 Stitches, the podcast, for those of you who have room in your life for multiple podcasts, of course, everyone should make sure to go listen to that. For those of you who haven't been able to catch up with it, a little different format than Down on the Farm, and I really like what you're doing with that the podcast, Alex, doing kind of different things. Some episodes focusing on one player, some episodes focusing on, I don't know, reliever usage or, you know, robot arms calling the strike zone and things like that. It's really been kind of interesting format that you've been maybe a little more free to be a little more creative with, perhaps might be one way to put it.
Let's just say whimsical.
Whimsical, all right.
Topically whimsical.
Whimsical, I like it. I like it. But it's definitely been a great listen. You know, just listening back, the most recent one I listened to, I've been listening to them out of order, but the Robbie Scott episode was great. Even just if you're not interested in Robbie Scott, if you're interested in becoming a journalist, those of you out there who are maybe college students or high school students wanting to become journalists, doing an interview with someone and seeing them warm up over the course of an interview, by the end, it was like you guys were best friends, whereas I think he maybe wasn't necessarily used to getting the media attention, perhaps, in Pawtucket. And it seemed like he got a lot more comfortable going along. It was a great, great listen. I really appreciate that.
And his is a great, great story that's I take no credit for it. It's but he's had a kind of interesting Forrest Gump player development path.
That's a good way to put it. That's a good way to put it. But of course, the reason we're all here today, in addition, everyone should follow those things, but recently released on Baseball America's website and soon to come in the Prospect Handbook, where your rankings of the top 30, well, the top 10 is available, but it will be the top 30 players in the Red Sox farm system. The top 10, we already will have told everyone what the top 10 rankings are in our introduction, Alex, but I guess what I'll do to start is the way we have started, I think, for the most part when we've had you on, is just sort of a state of the system. On our last episode, we talked our rankings and our kind of conclusions about the system where, you know, it's top heavy as it's been in a while. It's basically the top four or five and then maybe a very clear six, and then it really sort of drops off. And then kind of after that, it might be the weakest depth-wise the system's been since about 2011 or 2012 was our conclusion. Are those kind of your takes on the system as well? What's your sort of from the 10,000 foot level view of how things are in the farm system having gone through the process?
I think you're spot on. I do think that it's clearly it has an elite top of the system, top four, top five that very few organizations can match. Mm-hmm. And then after that, I think that it's strong six through eight, six through nine. I think that you'd find a considerable amount of trade interest in players like Sam Travis, Mauricio Dubon, who I have at seven, Luis Alexander Basabe, whom, you know, some people think the Diamondbacks intended to acquire him. He got the wrong Basabe at number eight. And Bobby Dalbec made a heck of an impression in his pro debut. He was my number nine. But beyond that, it kind of the fall off is pretty considerable in terms of industry-wide value, and even in many cases, in terms of upside. It's just, you know, there used to be more lottery tickets in the system, mm-hmm. and a couple of things happened. One is that they started trading they've been more aggressive trading away younger prospects,
sure.
Which isn't a surprise. That's kind of what Dave Dombrowski was brought in to do, but he's done it. And so as a result of moving, you know, a half dozen strong prospects, you suddenly have a thinner system. I think that, you know, the top 10 would look very different this year, but for the trades of Manuel Margot and Anderson Espinoza and Logan Allen, for instance, at this mm-hmm. juncture. And, you know, you also had a period where the international pool was basically two international classes were taken away. I think that you would have had some of the signees of the class of last year's signing class kind of finding their way into this list. And then they were taken away. They were made free agents once MLB elected to penalize the Red Sox as they did for their international signing violations, in addition to the future impact, which was taking them out of the running for this coming year. Of course, the ultimate future impact could come a little further down the road when I imagine the Red Sox are going to come back with a vengeance spend a bazillion dollars in the international market this coming year. But at that broader level, absolutely right. You know, the impact is primarily at the top of the system, and you know the stack of trade chips that the Red Sox had to work from has been dwindling over the course of time.
Mm-hmm. Right, exactly. And I guess so. You see that drop coming after about nine, where that's really
I think that the precipitous drop. There's a significant drop off after 5. Mm-hmm. You know, when you get through Benintendi Moncada, Devers, Devers Kopech Groom, that's one class.
And sure.
With Moncada and Benintendi kind of in their own class, honestly. Mm-hmm. And then when you get through 6 through 9, I think that there are organizations that are pretty intrigued by those guys as, you know, as something. And then beyond that, it gets into a different caliber of prospect from an industry value standpoint.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, that said, whereas the tiers, I think you can more or less point out, there's some really interesting debates to be had within ranking those players. And of course, one of the most interesting ones at the top is Moncada versus Benintendi, to see who the top prospect in the system is. One that we can only really have because Benintendi got hurt, as you mentioned. Yeah. On your podcast with John Manuel. You've said that you feel like it's a 1 versus 1A debate, and I can't recall if it was you or John who said that they're both going to be in at least BA's top 5. What led to you picking Benintendi over Moncada in particular? And it did sound like it was one that you really went back and forth on. Is that the case?
I personally went back and forth on it. I went back and forth on it with John Manuel and other staffers at Baseball America. But, you know, keeping in mind that this is a snapshot in time, this is a single moment. You know, it is not who knows which one ends up being the better major leaguer. But, you know, based on what I heard, I would bet on Benintendi having the better career. And I think that the reason is you have a player with an elite hit tool that lends itself to consistently being a very good. His range of outcomes is kind of like very good to surpassingly good, right? Like, you know, the upper end projection is probably a little bit shy of Mookie Betts, but, you know, but not by too much. In terms of overall dynamic impact and being able to impact the game in every way with an elite ability to get on base, both by hitting the ball and by not striking out, taking his walks, etc. Like one evaluator said, you know, if you were to evaluate power, power to include doubles, this is a guy who he saw hitting, you know, 50 doubles a year with like 15 to 20 home run power and maybe another 10 triples. He could see the guy having 80 extra base hits a year. So, you know, when you look at things in that context, then all of a sudden, some of the different gradations of skill sets that we view between Benintendi and Moncada, I don't know. I think that the floor for Benintendi is so compelling and it's clearly above Moncada's because we saw the swing and miss proclivities that Moncada went through, both in Portland and then again in the big leagues. There's a sizable floor gap that in turn led to the outcome that, you know, of Benintendi 1 with Moncada 2. As I talk to people across the industry, you know, numerous evaluators inside and outside the Red Sox organization, there was a very divided opinion about which one belongs as the number one. But the one thing that was fascinating was that, to me at least, was the people who saw Moncada as number one said it's close, but the people who saw Benintendi as number one, based on both the hit tool as well as, you know, the exceptional makeup and aptitude, said that it was for them. A lot of them said it's Benintendi and it's not close, which, you know, I take a lot from people who have strong convictions about these sorts of things. You know, when they've reached a when you hear a number of people reaching the same strong conclusion, then it tends to kind of get you past the divide.
Interesting. And I, you know, the other thing I was wondering too, because this is something that I've started to wonder about myself, and I'm sure you probably had to have your list into Baseball America before Moncada was removed from the Arizona Fall League, correct?
No, that was factored in, and
okay.
Durability has been a concern, I think, with Moncada dating to last year.
Right, that's what I was going to ask, because this is the fourth injury that he's missed a couple of weeks with, if you count the one that delayed his initial assignment to Greenville last year as well, I think. So I was just wondering how much of a concern that is becoming among, you know, sources across the game or and for you.
Yeah, I think it is. I think that it's becoming something of a concern. And, you know, you watch the guy play, and because he's such a physical specimen, you know, it's like he plays really hard. I think that it's to his credit. Mm-hmm. He's an intense, intense player, you know, and he moves like a freight train around the field at a lot of times. Like, you know, being able to take that body and move with the speed he does, It is hard to slow down, right? In order to slow down, you require these powerful slides that have led to injuries in certain instances, or sometimes it's, you know, other elements of his game. But I just think that Benintendi plays with a fluidity and ease that, you know, that maybe will lend itself to some injury protection. Although, of course, he also suffered an injury in Tampa Bay this year that we shouldn't overlook. But
of course,
I do wonder. Yeah, I do have that question about Moncada's durability, because he's had, you know, he's missed 5 games a week at a time here and there, whereas Benintendi, save for that one injury, has done a pretty darn good job of staying on the field.
Mm-hmm. Of course, not exactly an enormous sample size for either two. So who knows? But yeah. Fair point. Matt?
Yeah, I wanted to jump to the other kind of debate in the top five. You know, Devers just kind of locked into that number three spot. Maybe a little kind of flies under the radar a little bit, but the other big debate is between the two pitchers, Kopech and Jason Groom at 4 and 5. And, you know, Kopech obviously lit it up in the AFL. That huge fastball has got a lot of people excited. But I think there's some questions whether how much those secondaries will develop, especially the change up, the third pitch, whereas Groom maybe a little bit more of a 3-4 pitch mix, makes him maybe more, you know, have a higher floor of a starter potentially. But he's so far away too. So, and lefty versus righty, they're so different in a lot of ways that it's hard to compare them. But what are your thoughts on those two?
Yeah, it's a bit tricky in terms of apples to apples, but I mean there were scouts who walked out of seeing Kopech pitching, and I mean literally, like, there was one who asked himself, is this the best arm I've ever seen in my life? Hmm. You know, and it's like he has shown like this distinctive electricity in terms of what he does on the mound that has separated him from Groom. You know, professional experience matters. And I think that that's what, you know, that was the fact that he has blown away opposing hitters in the upper levels and at times in the AFL. Like, it's not in every start, obviously. He's laid some eggs as well, but he's shown the proclivity to absolutely dominate, you know, moving up these levels. That counts. And so I think that was the separator for them, in addition to the fact that, you know, it's just like Kopech just isn't that far from the big leagues, which also... I guess that some of it depends on what ultimately it is that you're ranking for. But proximity to the majors, you know, has relevance. It has relevance in terms of industry value, which is part of the equation. It has relevance to the team's view of their value, right? I mean, Dave Dombrowski typically won't trade guys who are knocking on the door as contributors to his team. He will trade guys who are a little bit further away because he has a chance to adjust the state of his farm system or the state of his organization with those guys who are further away. So those are some of the factors that play in. But I think, you know, based on I've only seen Groom pitch once. I saw his pro debut in the GCL. You are immediately impressed by the ease of his delivery, the just kind of natural feel that he has for multiple pitches. You have no idea how, as when I saw him, I forget if he had just turned 18 like the previous couple of days or if he was just about to turn 18, but there is a question of how he'll develop physically. I think that I don't know that Kopech has that question of how he's going to develop physically. He seems to be developing just fine. And so I think that there's a higher degree of certainty. There's a chance. Well, I was going to say there's a chance that Groom has the higher ceiling. I don't think that's true. I think that they both have legitimate, like, top of the rotation ceilings. You would hear most people say they have the ceiling of a number two and they don't hang a future number one on anyone. You know, like you get a number two and maybe they'll become a number one. But I would say that Groom may have more ways to get there, but because of how far away he is, he also has more ways not to get there.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. I think that's fair. You know, the thing I was wondering with those two is with Kopech, you mentioned that it's a snapshot in time. does the way that you're able to look at this, or the, not able to look at it, but the way that you look at this, change perhaps if the last two outings that you have are the last two outings that he ended the year on, where, you know, the first, his last regular season outing, he didn't make it out of the first, and then in the playoff game, he didn't make it out of the third. Obviously, you're not going to let that completely change your ranking of a guy or your perspective on him, but, you know, if there are more maybe questions than answers and he doesn't come back with this resounding answer in the Arizona Fall League of, nope, I figured it out, I'm okay, does that make it maybe a little harder to say that he's separated himself from Groom, whereas maybe it'd be a little closer?
Nope. The separation had occurred to me, I think, before the AFL. And in fact, I talked to a scout who had Kopech as his number two in the Red Sox organization. And he had that after having seen his only look at Kopech this year, I think, was one of those last two starts. Okay. And he still came away saying, like, I couldn't believe that arm. I just couldn't believe it. Like, it's, you know, maybe he was tired. Maybe something was a little bit off in his final start of the year. Maybe because of, you know, maybe he was kind of hitting that dead arm period that sometimes guys will hit in May, based on his late starts of the season. But, you know, but no, the AFL didn't play into it.
Interesting. All right. Well, I guess getting past that, one of the kind of things that I guess it didn't really jump out at me, because I knew from reading 108 Stitches and you know, reading you on Twitter and things like that, that you were high on Roniel Raudes. But you've got him up at 9 as a guy who basically has Dalbec. But you've got him at 10 as a guy who has pretty much the opposite arsenal of Kopech, perhaps.
Yeah.
Struggles to break 90, never mind 100. But obviously, he's kind of a tough guy for me to rank, because held his own at his age in the South Atlantic League at, 18 all year. But the stuff just really doesn't do anything for you if you were just looking at the stuff. What were the reports you were getting on him, and how confident were you to push him up into that top 10 over the likes of, say, a guy who is close to the majors and Brian Johnson, who of course has his own separate issues that maybe we can touch on, but ranking Raudes, how was that exercise for you, and what pushed you to put him at 10?
Yeah, Raudes and Johnson was actually a really interesting question for me, and it was kind of that was a pretty close one for me to kind of sift through, because I think that, you know, Johnson is maybe close to the majors, but his stuff backed up considerably after he came back. After he came back from his treatment for anxiety, I think that, like, honestly, my view of his makeup was already probably high, but it went up by virtue of the fact that he was courageous enough to step away from his career and recognize that he had to get, you know, that he had to get his life in order before he could. He was strong enough to be able to walk away from that kind of proximity to the major leagues. I think that that is a great testament to him as an individual. That said, when he did come back, look, his stuff has always been kind of fringy, right? Like, it's been, you know, it's the curveball plays, but the curveball was the one pitch that he had as a weapon, but it necessarily needs to have that full complement of pitches. And if he's, you know, we saw it when he was in the majors, when he was 86 to 88, and granted, that was a terrible sample based on some weirdness that was, right, that surrounded his debut in the middle of 2015, but 86 to 88. We've seen it with Henry Owens. If it doesn't play, you know, it's really hard to be a good pitcher when you're working with that kind of velocity. That's what he was at when he was in AAA last year. His curveball didn't show the same bite when he came back. He started throwing strikes again, which is promising for him. But to me, he's kind of this question mark until he shows up. Until we see how he shows up in 2017, because it's been a while since he's had a healthy live arm. With Raudes, I think that honestly, some of the traits of Johnson and Raudes are kind of similar in terms of, you know, creativity, attacking opposing hitters, multi-pitch mix, not necessarily with anything that plays current, that, you know, that plays as like an outrageous trick pitch or something. No Bugs Bunny, you know, mix in the arsenal or anything. But with Raudes, you have what looks like a projectable, a three pitch mix of at least average pitches. But with that comes a certain degree of deception, right? Like clearly there's something about the way that he delivers the ball, and he has some, you know, so he has some interesting mechanisms that he incorporates both to hide the ball and to disrupt opposing hitters' timing, including that little modified T-on pivot.
It's funky.
Yeah, it's funky and it's original, and that's as a young guy. So there's an interesting sense for – there's a sophistication about how he approaches pitching. There is a willingness to attack the strike zone and an ability to attack the strike zone with three pitches. The command projects as being, you know, as being clearly plus, maybe 65 grade. And I think that there's – you know, he's 18 years old, which means that if he's showing you stuff, if he's flashing, like if he's showing – average stuff across the board right now, there's a decent chance that something plays up, especially because he is someone who's willing, who seems to just have a sense for how to make some adjustments that they can allow him to play up. Now, it's a little bit speculative. It's you know, I view him as a good floor guy for being, you know, an 18-year-old in single A. I think that his ceiling, you know, you have a broad range of perspectives on it. I think that the highest the highest compliment given to his ceiling that I encountered was a suggestion that, you know, this is like an Irvin Santana, like, you know, that he could develop into an Irvin Santana like guy, you know, who's like Santana has a similar frame, very whippy little arm. He's able to mix and just, you know, throw strikes in different ways in order to be able to get hitters out. That's not a bad ceiling. That ceiling would put him ahead of Johnson, whose ceiling I think right now is probably capped as that of a number four, maybe number five. But, you know, Braudez is just kind of interesting, and I think it's easier to see, based on what has been seen over the last 18 months, it's easier to see his upside right now than maybe it is even Johnson's. Johnson could disprove me in spring training, and that'd be great. But for right now, until his stuff comes back, that's why I had Raudis ahead.
Like you said, snapshot in time.
Yep.
Yeah, and just above that in the sort of 6 to 9 range, it seems like, you know, it seems like at least for us, Sam Travis sort of locked into that sixth spot. And you can let me know if you disagree. But after
I
that,
had it fluid between 6, 7, and 8. Like I heard different people putting Basabe or Dubon ahead of Travis. That was a fluid mix.
Okay, interesting. I was going to ask you sort of how you came down with Dubon in that next spot, and sort of the comparison between him and Marco Hernandez, who we have sort of back to back in our rankings, and, you know, somewhat similar projections. I'm just wondering what kind of separates the two for you.
I think that Dubon is a legitimate shortstop. I think that his clock just works better for all of the infield positions that he plays. So I think that there's a better feel for the game from Dubon. I think that that is going to translate to greater value. I think that it's going to be easy for him to take on whatever role is, you know, made available to him, whether that's as a utility guy. There are teams that think that he can be a starting shortstop or second baseman in the big leagues. With Hernandez, I think that the ceiling, if he exceeds the likeliest profile, which is like Dubon as a utility guy, then his likeliest role would be as an everyday second baseman. So from that vantage point, slightly less value than Dubon. I haven't heard a lot of optimism that Hernandez could be a super utility guy who could take on the outfield. I saw Dubon make some okay plays in the outfield in the AFL. I think that he has a pretty good chance of being just more adaptable, more kind of fit, a more precise fit for that super utility role. I think that the makeup for Dubon, like just the feel for the game, is so good. I mean, it's really what he's doing as a guy who grew up in Honduras and like moved to Sacramento as a high school junior and really has not that much exposure to the game on a full-time basis is pretty remarkable. And there are just a lot of people who believe in Dubon as a kind of impact player, whether it's in that kind of super utility role that now exists and has become so important in the current baseball landscape. Whereas I think that Hernandez, my guess is that on a first division team, he's a utility infielder, not a super utility guy like a Brock Holt. He is left-handed, which gives him an advantage over Dubon. But I'm impressed by both of their hit tools. I think that I think that Dubon's clock plays in a way that that separates him a little bit from Hernandez.
You mentioned that some teams see Dubon as a starting shortstop. Is your sense that, you know, and if you've received this directly and don't want to say I'll give you the out by saying, is it your sense, but that the Red Sox are or aren't one of those teams? Because I just find it interesting that they're, I think they've come out and said the reason he's playing center field some in the AFL is to get him that super utility exposure, I guess. Do you think that in a pinch, say, Xander Bogaerts goes down for the year with some ACL injury or something, you know, God forbid, at some point could Dubon take over that role, or is that maybe, do they see that being a little over his head?
I would think that the Red Sox see, I wouldn't be surprised if the Red Sox came to the conclusion that Dubon was their best option as an everyday shortstop if Bogaerts were to go down for any length of time. I would not be surprised by that at all. I think that, you know, the sum of the parts, I think, have made a very favorable impression on a lot of people in the organization. They might be suboptimal for the first half of until he's gotten some exposure to AAA, especially. But, you know, he has oftentimes required a little period of adjustment at different levels, or at least he did in Salem. I guess that was the most glaring instance of it. He's been pretty darn good in a lot of other levels. But I think that, you know, say second half of 2017, if Bogaerts were to be injured, I would be surprised if anyone, but if someone except Dubon was viewed as the best shortstop starting depth option.
Interesting.
Who would you have ahead of him?
Who do we have? Well, there was some debate on Dubon versus Hernandez, and I think we might have come to a conclusion in the last podcast that we ranked him behind Hernandez because of a misunderstanding, but it's Travis, Basabe, and then with Brian Johnson.
I just mean as a shortstop. If Bogaerts went down, you know.
No, it's no one ahead of him in the system, but whether they view him as a player that could field shortstop over a full season or multiple season period, as someone who could handle shortstop as your everyday shortstop. I guess it was a poor way of asking that very simple question. But in the system, I agree with you that it's certainly not Devin Marrero at this point.
Yeah, unless they wanted to go straight glove, you know.
Yeah. Well, the glove's not even there anymore, frankly, based on what we've seen and heard there. The glove's barely even good. It's kind of funny listening back to our podcast last year today. It was kind of crazy to me that Devin Marrero was a top 10 prospect at this point a year ago.
I certainly had him there, and, you know, it's been a pretty precipitous decline when you post the worst OPS in full season minor league baseball.
Well, I didn't even realize that he had gotten that low. Yikes. I guess switching gears a little bit, the 2016 draft, for right now at least, obviously when we came out of it, it looked like it was going to be the Jason Groom and everybody else draft. But then, of course, Bobby Dalbec went and made a mockery of the New York Penn League and made your top 10. But I guess as a whole, guys like, obviously we know where you put Dalbec and Groom, but guys like a Sean Anderson, a Mike Shawari, and a CJ Chatham, maybe even some of the guys lower down, what was the take on them? How does this draft look a half a season out, and is there anyone that kind of stood out for being maybe a little higher or a little lower than where it seemed like they might be when they were drafted?
Well, I think Dalbec is the one who really jumped his status, right?
Of course.
You know, to make it up to number nine for a guy who came into the system with all kinds of swing and miss and, you know, approach questions and who hit, you know, I mean, he hit like Babe Ruth, right? Like, I mean, literally like Babe Ruth when he was in Lowell. So that was pretty good and surprising. I think that Chatham probably, you know, for me falls in roughly the range that you might expect a second rounder to fall. I was actually pretty impressed by what people were seeing in Shawarin in terms of his ability to be a starter going forward and thinking that he had a chance to be pretty good. I heard positive things. I didn't hear much anything that was particularly enthusiastic about Anderson, you know, for what it's worth, but he had a dreadful start to his pro day, to his pro career. Maybe he bounces back, or maybe he's the next Austin Maddox. I heard very good things about Nogasek. There's real intrigue about what he might be able to become as a straight bullpen progression. But yeah, I think that overall, you know, in the current state of the draft, when you're looking down at, you know, through five rounds and seeing, you know, seeing almost a handful of impact of potential impact guys, that's a pretty darn good draft.
Yeah, definitely. Especially with Dahlbeck, it's interesting to me what would have happened if they had, you don't want to say been able to promote him, because they certainly could have, but it seemed pretty clear at one point that he was staying in Lowell because they were going to make the playoff run. And where if they weren't going to make the playoffs, he would have gotten the same bump to Greenville that Andrew Benintendi got last year. It was kind of crazy to me to look and see no comp for the numbers he put up. I mean, he put up better numbers than Benintendi did, although I didn't isolate the split when Benintendi got his act together after that first week. Got his act together is probably not the right way to put it, but definitely intriguing to see what he does. You know,
that's pretty good company, you know, when you're like trying to figure out, oh, is he better or or the same as Benintendi and Lowell? That's pretty good.
And actually, Matt, I hope you don't mind if I jump in with this, but just kind of leading out of that Dahlbeck question, something that you had also mentioned on your podcast with John Manuel is the state of third base in the system, where you've got, if you count Yoan Moncada, Rafael Devers, Bobby Dahlbeck, and, you know, to a degree, at least as a top 20 guy, Michael Chavis, you know, we've got him in our top 20 at 14, to the 14,
yeah,
15
range. Yeah, close to that, I think.
Yeah. Certainly it's one thing to have that in the minors, but then when you look in the majors, certainly there's a spot there for someone, whether it winds up being Moncada that takes it or whether he winds up somewhere else. But the way we kind of talked about this in our last episode is it seems like down the line, especially given the defensive step forward that Rafael Devers made this year, the system's minor league defensive player of the year, I think, by the way, they gave him. It seems like there's four spots for the three guys that are going to be the starting outfield next year of Betts, Bradley, and Benintendi, Yoan Moncada, and Rafael Devers. If you consider that Moncada could, in theory, move to the outfield down the line, what is your feel for how the organization views that situation going forward? Not that Devers is even going to be ready in 2017 necessarily, but assuming those guys all develop the way they should, do you have any feel for what they're thinking there? Is that maybe the area they try and deal from if a Chris Sale type, not to bring up, as you put it, this season's white whale, you know, this year's Felix Hernandez, Giancarlo Stanton, but is that where they might deal from? Do you think that that's just an area where they let it play out and wait, or is this another area where, you know, Trader Dave, as the detractors may put him, tries to deal from either this offseason or next trade deadline?
Well, I think that, you know, I think that if you're looking to have a big chip, you know, the you have the flexibility to consider dealing either Moncada or Devers, in theory, by virtue of that. Now, you can also find a way for them to be complementary. As you pointed out, you know, you could, theoretically down the line, you could have Moncada going into left field. Let's say Jackie Bradley Jr. is used as a chip. Benintendi goes to center. Betts is in right. I don't think Betts is getting traded, like, at any point. You know, I can't imagine Betts being traded at any point. I can't imagine Bradley being traded. I have a hard time imagining Benintendi being traded. But, yeah, I mean, I think that it gives you flexibility. I think that it's a matter that they aren't particularly – they don't feel a particular urgency to resolve right now. I do think that right now Devers probably there's a pretty good chance that Devers has a decent chance to be a better defensive third baseman than Moncada. Right now, he's certainly a better defensive third baseman than Moncada, based on just, you know, reliability and the feel for the position. Devers is really he's pretty damn good at that position. Yeah. So, you know, it does open up a number of different possibilities, though. You could, you know, theoretically have Devers move over to first base. We should not forget that, you know, that Dustin Pedroia is probably not immortal and probably not going to occupy second base for the rest of this century. So, you know, so there's theoretically the possibility that down the line Moncada could move back to second base. Let's say that Devers requires two more years in the minors, then you're looking at 2019, you know, getting closer to the end of Pedroia's contract, and who knows how often he's playing. There are different ways to finagle it, I suppose, is the best way of putting it. And none of it is imminent enough that they've had to kind of go through the exercise of, well, how do, you know, do we make this fit or do we need to trade one? But I think that, you know, I think that there's an awareness that they're probably going to be playing in some, in the deep end of some pools with regards to trade discussions. And as they do, they're probably going to have to make available some of their very good prospects in that top five, because if you're trying to deal a good piece to them, you know, as we mentioned before, the drop off is significant enough that it's, that it kind of becomes a non-starter.
Yeah, I want to ask you about those outside your top 10, which is obviously published at this point. Who are a couple guys, one or two guys, maybe that you had a tough time leaving off, or maybe just guys that intrigued you? And then outside leaving of
just to clarify, Matt, leaving out of the top 10.
Yeah. Who are tough to leave off the top 10? And then yeah, also like a deep sleeper, if you have a name or two.
Sure. I think that the biggest question, you know, I did wrestle with that number 10 spot. For me, the top nine spots through Dahlbeck were all pretty clear. I think that once you got down to number 10, then there was some interesting debate about, you know, about Raudez versus Johnson, who is someone who had kind of proven it in the upper levels, versus, let's say, a CJ Chatham, who did, I think, make a pretty favorable impression in his debut, or even a Marco Hernandez for some of the reasons that we mentioned above. I mean, that's a guy who's just about major league ready to be a utility infielder with some interesting bat life and an interesting set of tools. There are plenty of people who like Marco Hernandez pretty well throughout the industry. So I think that those were some of the guys who were in the conversation at number 10. In terms of deep sleepers looking a little further down, I suppose that, you know, one that qualifies as such would be that Victor Diaz made such a tremendous impression on everyone with what he was doing down the stretch in Greenville, when he was just utterly overpowering with, like, so he throws 95 to 100, but the fastball isn't what gets swings and misses. But he added kind of two, he now has potentially two swing and miss secondary offerings in both a slider and a splitter that give him an opportunity to attack people, kind of closer potential. He has a chance to fly through the system in 2017. I mean, I wouldn't completely dismiss him as a major league possibility for late 2017. He was that good, even though he finished the year in A-ball. And then beyond that, you know, thinking relative to your rankings, especially, I was more bullish on Josh Pennington than you guys were. You guys had him at 27. I had him a good deal above that, although you guys had found out that he had a minor surgery after the season, which impacted your rankings. I was unaware of that until you guys informed me of that. However, it wasn't brought up by anyone I talked to about Pennington for 2017. So I assume, I mean, there's a pretty sizable contingent of people who think that he has pretty impressive stuff that gives him an opportunity to make some real impact.
I was going to say, it does sound like he'll be ready for spring training as far as we've heard on that. Sounds like it was something fairly minor.
Yeah, so that being the case, I mean, you know, the stuff that he showed some legitimately electric stuff. I mean, this was a guy who, in the showcase circuit as a high schooler, was getting amazing numbers of swings and misses while he was working in the high 80s. But now he's kind of working in the high 90s with you know, the great Tommy John, you know, step forward in stuff. So he's someone with a chance to make considerable headway in the rankings going forward as he gets to full season ball.
And Alex, I guess something that's maybe not only outside the rankings, but I guess outside the prospect world, but instead on the major league club, you wrote in 108 Stitches today about what a Mookie Betts extension might look like. And I was just kind of curious. I would suggest to everyone, of course, that they go read that and subscribe to the newsletter again.
Why, thank you.
And apparently my cat in the background agrees with me. But I just wanted to see what your feel was for the chances that the Red Sox do try and make that happen and extend him before opening day, or perhaps also a Xander Bogaerts, who is, of course, you know, a guy who is one of the top young shortstops in the game, but maybe at this point is lagging a shade behind the Francisco Lindor type young shortstop level, maybe a Carlos Correa type guy, maybe get a chance to lock him up before opening day while he's occupying the space he's in, as opposed to maybe making a jump forward similar to the kind that Betts made this year. Either of those guys, you getting a feel for what they might do?
I think that there's generally, this will come as a little surprise, in the industry there's general skepticism that they would be able to extend Bogaerts because he's represented by Scott Boras.
And, right.
You know, the sense is that he would have to kind of take the proverbial bull by the horns and say, this is something I really want if he is to get extended at this early stage of his career as a first-time arbitration eligible. As for Betts, I think that through the industry, there's slightly greater, there's slightly greater intrigue as to whether or not he would be open to an extension. That said, I think that, that said, it would take an awful lot. And the Red Sox are in a kind of strange payroll place right now, where in terms of their actual financial commitments to Major League, to the Major League payroll, and they count Alan Craig and Ruzne Castillo on that, even though they're off the 40-man, they're already kind of committed up north of $200 million, and maybe only, if assuming they keep a nugget for flexibility in season, probably only $5 or $10 million behind where they finished this past season. So, it's a little bit interesting with Betts. I wonder if maybe it'll be one of those deals where maybe they'll kind of just do a 1 year, do his 1 year pre-arb deal this year. But then maybe after opening day, they will be able to explore what a long-term deal looks like. But, at this point in his career, this is a guy who's 24 years old, and he's a top three MVP candidate, obviously, and maybe an MVP winner. You're looking at kind of the comps are like Buster Posey in his 9-year, $167 million deal, and Freddie Freeman in his, 8-year, $135 or something deal. So, it will take an awful lot of money. I wouldn't be surprised if it required like 7 and 150 or something in order to be able to extend Betts at this point. And that's a pretty significant amount of change to be dropping on a guy. But I think that there's also pretty good reason to believe that he could earn it.
Yeah, $135 on Freeman. So you were right on it.
Woohoo!
Ian, good work. Ian, I think you had one question you wanted to add, and then we can finish up.
Yeah, just kind of looking as an overview, something we've discussed pretty heavily is that it seems like there's a real lack of position player prospects in the system. And I was just wondering if after like the top 10, is that something you encountered where you're pretty much picking between your choice of, guys who might be relievers or maybe best case is a back end starter. And there just doesn't seem to be a lot of position player talent there.
1,000,000%. It is a staggering thing to go through like the back end of this top 30 and be like, well, is he, to kind of parse whether or not the guy who has a chance to be a same handed specialist ranks slightly ahead of the guy with a chance to be a seventh inning guy. I mean, I think that there is a real lack of impact position players, and it's going to be you're very astute in observing that. I think it is going to become an issue for the Red Sox at some point because it will impact the depth of their major league team. Their ability to withstand injuries is going to be very much an open question at various points, which is why someone like Dubon might seem like he's a great trade candidate because, you have Brock Holt or whatever. But my gosh, you need to be able to cover yourself in as many spots as possible, probably with as few guys as possible. So it may be really hard for the Red Sox not to have at least two of the three of Holt, Dubon, Hernandez around in their system for a goodly while to come because further down in their system, there just aren't a lot of guys who look like they are going to be able to supply that kind of solid depth to their position playing core for the next couple of years.
Well, and then kind of playing off of that, do you think that's something that could potentially, you mentioned earlier that if depending on how the international rules turn out, there's a very good chance that the Red Sox go big this summer when they're finally allowed to spend again. Do you think that will have any impact on how they approach either A, trades, or B, the free agency, with the idea that if they give up their first round pick again, that's another potential opportunity to add talent taken away, given how little depth there is at the low minors?
It's a great question, and I don't have a great feel for the answer because I do think, you know, there is still, to a degree, a newness about figuring out, you know, Dave Dombrowski's operating MO, you know, or I suppose that's redundant. Dave Dombrowski's MO would have sufficed. But yeah, I think that, you know, I think that he does value, pretty clearly value the draft pick. That was part of the calculus with regards to pursuing a guy like Price last year, for instance. And, you know, he felt very good about keeping the draft pick around with obvious payoff, right? You know, think about what happens if they sign Greinke, say, instead of Price, and then you don't have a guy like Groom in the system. So I think that that may weigh into it. How that affects international, I'm not sure. I was actually very curious to see whether or not they would, you know, kind of throw their weight into pursuing guys like Lourdes Gurriel, because that's a quick way to repopulate the, you know, the upper level depth, position playing depth of your system. They obviously didn't do it with him, in part because he most likely plays a position where they have the prospects we were talking about, the third base prospects that we were already talking about. But I can see them. This is just kind of spitballing ideas. I can certainly see them becoming a little bit more aggressive in, say, the Cuban market for players who are 23 and older in the short term, to be able to kind of bolster some of that position playing depth that really seems like it's being thinned out pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Yeah. Like you said, if they keep this format for the international market too next year, that seems like another place where they're going to hit hard. An area where, hey, I mean, Eddie Romero getting a promotion this offseason shows the work they think he's doing in terms of bringing in those players. So
the line would have been really long to hire him in a second. Oh, I mean, yeah. I think that they, you know, they were in a position where, you know, where they were going to have to promote one or both of Amiel or Eddie in order to keep them. And I think that they probably recognized that pretty quickly as well.
Yeah, it did seem pretty clear as soon as Hazen left that was going to happen. Either they were going to go with him or get promoted. All right, well, I think, assuming these guys are spent as well, Alex, thank you so much for coming on this weeknight. We appreciate all the work you do. We will be keeping an eye on your 108 Stitches newsletter and listening to the 108 Stitches podcast. Follow him online at Alex Speer. Alex, we can't wait to welcome you back next year when you join the Five Timers Club with, I think, Alec Baldwin's in there and Steve Martin or something like that.
That's amazing. Well, let me just say, I appreciate the steak knives, but don't bring them with you to Fort Myers. Bad idea to bring them on an airplane.
Okay, good to know. That's smart. Excellent. Well, everybody, for Alex Speer, we'll be back to close after this, but stay with us. All right, well, thank you, everybody, for the download. Thanks for listening again. Subscribe, rate, and review. We really appreciate it. Thanks again to Alex for coming on. Always a pleasure to talk to him. We'll be back at you soon, probably after the holiday, so everyone have a great Thanksgiving out there. And we'll be back in December, maybe working on a couple guests, working on some other things to talk about. Sure, there'll be plenty of hot stove to discuss as well. So thank you all for listening. Have a great holiday. We'll be back at you soon.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.